title of my talk changed last Friday, and after hearing the first talk of this morning, it changed again. So I'm going to give you the point of view of a pure stellar physicist about all these problems of chemical abundance anomalies, etc., and also IMS. So I will just remind you very briefly, since we've heard that many times this morning, that in any individual globular cluster, you find fairly good homogeneity as far as the iron peak elements and the neutron capture and alpha elements are concerned, which means that probably these elements come from pre-enrichment. They are not produced inside the globular cluster itself. However, when you look at the abundances of lighter elements from carbon to aluminum, you have very good reasons to believe that these anomalies are produced in situ inside the globular cluster. And we discussed already this morning the CN, oxygen, sodium, and magnesium interpolations. So I will just show you again this figure, which is coming out from Thibaud de Cresson's thesis. Just to remind you that in the field, you don't see this anticorrelation. And the starting value that you have for oxygen over sodium is the order of 0.6. And you find some of these stars that we call third-generation stars in all the clusters. The numbers are fairly small. It's 15 to 20% of these stars are first generation. And of course, you find many anomalous stars, which we call second generation, which can account up to 85% of the stars that you see today in the globular cluster. So the nucleosynthesis that's going on is very simple. It's hydrogen burning through CNO, neon sodium, and magnesium aluminum. And what is very important here is that in order to explain all the observations, you have to reach very high hydrogen burning temperature of the order of 72 to 78 million K. So where does such a high temperature occur during hydrogen burning in stars? This shows you the hydrogen burning temperature in stars of various initial masses. In red on the main sequence, this blue line shows you the observational requirements. And you see that the long-lived stars that we are looking at today are low-mass stars, so they never reach the high temperature that you need to explain these abundance anomalies. So this is why we think that it's a self-enrichment scenario of the globular cluster, that these stars did irritate their abundance anomalies. They didn't create extinction. Now, there are two possibilities to reach such high temperatures. One is massive stars, which reach a very high temperature already on the main sequence. And the other ones, as we heard today, is the massive AGB stars. So at the beginning, I didn't intend to speak about AGB stars because there was a talk of Franca and Raffaele. But after the talks of Judith, I thought it would be interesting to give more clues on what are the nucleosynthesis processes going on. And you will see that there may be some inconsistencies between the two suggestions. Okay, so this is a very ugly figure. I'm sorry, but that's all what I had during the coffee break. That shows you the Kiffenan diagram for an AGB star, which is undergoing successive thermal pulses. So here you have the inner core oxygen core surrounded by the helium burning shell, which from time to time undergoes a thermal runaway. So you have the convective thermal pulse that's going on here. And after the thermal pulse, you have the convective envelope that deepens inside the star and gives rise to what we call the star drudges. Now, what happens from the nucleosynthesis point of view is the following. Of course, because you have helium burning this thermal pulse, you end up producing carbon-12, but you also produce oxygen-16. And you also can capture alpha particles from uncapped nitrogen-14, which gives you some neon-22. And this neon-22 may capture also alpha particles. So you produce magnesium-25 and magnesium-26. Now you have the third dredge up, so you bring back to the surface these elements. And if your star is massive enough, then you will have the so-called hot bottom burning, where you undergo these chains and cycles here. So you may produce magnesium-24, you may produce aluminium-26, and you may change also the abundances of magnesium-25 and 26. So you see that you have a very subtle competition between the third dredge up, which brings back to the surface the products of helium burning, and in particular, in the AGB that in the AGV model that Judith was mentioning, the 25 and 26 is coming not from hydrogen burning, but from helium burning. So I will come back on that point just later on. And then you have also hot bottom burning that may change the abundances in a way or the other. So here I just show you very rapidly what happens if you have no subdredge up and only hot bottom burning. You have strong oxygen depletion. And at the beginning, you have sodium production because you have some available neon-22 inside the star at the beginning. But as soon as this neon-22 is eaten by proton capture, then sodium decreases again because you have very strong high temperature. Now, in the case where you have some subdredge up, you will increase the oxygen at the surface, and the hot bottom burning may not be able to destroy this oxygen. And on the other hand, after each thermal pulse, through sub-dredge up, you will bring back to the surface some neon-22 produced in the thermal pulse, and then you may increase the sodium-23. So here I show you the predictions by Fenner et al. That Judith used to look at the magnesium 25 and 26. And the predictions here are done for models with the MLT for convection that all the other authors quoted here also use. And you see immediately that you can not destroy very strongly the oxygen because you have this subdredge up that helps you bring in a lot of sodium to the surface. And on the other hand, here it's magnesium versus aluminum. In these models, you do not deplete magnesium, but you increase magnesium. And this is due to the dredge up of magnesium 25 and 26. So in the models that Judith showed this morning, which are from Fenner et al., you indeed increase magnesium 26. But this magnesium 26 comes from helium burning, which means that in her star, you should see also some increase of the total C+N+O, which is shown here. And as far as I know, for the moment, the C+N+O has been found constant in all the globular clusters where it has been looked at. So it would be interesting to have this value also in M75 in order to discriminate between the model. Now, another remark concerning the AGB stars, as Raffaele mentioned just before my talk, the yields of AGB stars depends a lot on the convection, the way you treat convection. And in particular, if you use, as Ventura and Antona do, the so-called FST, full spectrum of turbulence treatment for convection, you end up with much more efficient hot bottom burning than with MLT, which means that the star, the HB star for a given mass, will have higher luminosity, stronger mass loss, and less subdredge. So this is good because you don't bring so much helium burning products, and you may end up with strong oxygen depletion. So here is the abundance is from these models. The surface abundance of oxygen as a function of remaining mass, so in a way as a function of time, for 6.5.5, etc., solar masses stars. And you see that you can destroy oxygen, especially in the more massive stars. However, in the low mass stars, which are undergoing the third dredge-up, you produce oxygen. As Raffaele mentioned, in these models, you have some difficulties to explain the sodium enrichment. Here you have some strong sodium enrichment from the second dredge-up, which comes from the burning of the pristine neon-22. But as soon as this source is finished, then sodium decreases. Of course, you can play with nuclear reaction rates. There is kind of a possibility of freedom here. But the point that I would like to make here is that you end up with a very narrow mass range if you want to explain the anomalies, I mean, the oxygen depletion that you see in the globular cluster. So it's only stars with masses between 5 to 6.5 that can make it. And in that case, if you imagine that the globular cluster doesn't lose any mass from the beginning, and if you use a Salpeter IMF for the polluters, you only produce 8% of second generation compared to the 85% that you need. So this implies a very strange IMF with a slope of minus 0.65 instead of the Salpeter value of 1.35. Now, there is another point that is quite embarrassing for the intermediate mass star is the fact that, as all stars do, they are rotating. And now I'm going to show you some predictions for rotating intermediate mass stars, which take into account the most up-to-date treatment for the transport of angular momentum and chemicals through meridional scintillation and shear turbulence. This physics has been used successfully to explain, for example, the production of primary nitrogen at low metallicity by intermediate mass stars, so the same one that we are talking about for the black clusters. They have been used also to explain some anomalies of massive and low mass stars. So here, what happens when your AGB stars rotate? So here I show you some profiles of abundances, oxygen, helium, carbon, etc. In a non-rotating star and in a rotating star, these are the profiles before the second dredge-up. So what you see, the difference between the two models is that due to meridional circulation and turbulence, you spread up the helium burning products in the hydrogen burning region, which means that in this region where the convective envelope is going to deepen during the second dredge-up, you enhance by a lot the oxygen abundance, and also, well, also carbon, etc. All the helium burning products are going to spread out outside. So when the convective envelope deepens, you bring back this abundance, these elements to the surface, and you end up, before the thermal pulse, you end up with a strong increase in the total CP temperature, which strongly depends on metallicity. So this is completely incompatible with the constant CP temperature that we see in the globular clusters, and it cannot be erased during the further CP AGB phase. So now we turn to the subject of my talk, which is massive stars. So based on the fact that we see in young massive clusters, massive rotating stars rotating faster than in the field, we have constructed the so-called wind of fast rotating massive star scenario. Again, the models that I will show you take into account the same transport of angular momentum and chemicals by meridional circulation and turbulence, which is needed to explain many other abundance anomalies and chemical evolution of the galaxy. So what happens when you have a fast, initially fast rotating star is the following. So this is a schedule of such a star. The colors give you the composition of the different regions. In green, you have the pristine abundances. So you have the starting value O over Na of 0.6. And in blue, you have the products of hydrogen burning. When the star is rotating fast, you have a very strong transport of angular momentum from the core to the surface due to meridional circulation and turbulence. And very soon, the star is going to reach at the breakup velocity, which means that the centrifugal acceleration compensates gravity. And in that case, you form an equatorial matter is released in a Keplerian orbit. So in that case, you have the formation of a slow outflowing disk, such that the ones that we see around these stars, and the wind, the mass loss is mainly through mechanical wind instead of radiative wind. I will come back in that point later. You see that at the beginning in the disk, you start losing mass, which has the pristine composition with this oxygen over sodium of 0.6. But the transport of chemicals is going to bring the helium burning products to the surface. You see that this blue region starts to spread out due to transport of chemicals. And very soon, the surface of the star at the disk will be strongly enriched in these hydrogen burning products. So inside your disk, you produce a range of oxygen over sodium, which goes from the starting value of 0.6 to the minus 2 value, which actually cover the range that we observe today in the low mass stars. So an important point is that these helium burning products can be ejected in a mechanical wind, as I explained just before. And so they can be easily retained in the globular cluster potential well, and they are then made available to form new stars. So in our scenario, we assume that star formation does occur in the immediate vicinity of individual massive stars, and this is triggered by the ionization. Very recently in these BE stars, there have been some indications of clumps or protostars that have been observed in the disk of such stars. So this could be connected with this formation in the disk. Another important point is that due to this mechanical wind, a star on the main sequence loses a large amount of its mass. Here for a 60 solar mass, you see the evolution of the mass as a function of remaining hydrogen burning in the center. And you see that in this configuration, a star loses 20 solar masses, while in the case of pure radiative wind, you lose only one solar mass. So it's a large amount of gas, which is made available to form new stars, second generation stars, with the proper composition. Now, what happens later is the following. As soon as the star leaves the LBV phase, the structure is going to readjust, and the star is actually moving away from Brettert, which means that it comes back to the classical situation where the radiating winds are taking over. And it's just at that moment that the helium burning products come at the surface. So at that moment, the disk, which is disconnected from the star, doesn't receive these helium burning products, which are ejected through the very strong and very fast radiatively driven winds. So the stellar ejecta of these more advanced phases cannot be retained in the globular cluster potential zone. Here I show you the predictions for the surface abundances for a 60 solar mass star. So the different elements are here. The different tracks shows you computations made with different values for the nuclear reactions. And the shaded area shows you the magnitude of abundance variations in NGC 6752. And so you see that we can deplete carbon, we increase sodium, etc. And very importantly, when you have the hydrogen burning products coming out, that's just at the moment where you have the slow mechanical wind that can stay inside the cluster. However, when you start to see the helium burning products at the surface, that's just the moment where the fast radiatively driven winds come out. Now I have added this figure for Judith, also for the others, of course. But, this is the predictions for the same stars for the magnesium isotopic ratios. So you see that in the case where you deplete magnesium-24, you also increase magnesium-26. So there's a way with massive stars to explain these isotopic ratios that she's finding without enriching the matter with helium burning products, which is different from what you would find from HED stars. So I think that at that point, having the C+N2SO is very crucial to discriminate between the two scenarios. Of course, the computations have been made here for NGC 6752, and M71 is a little bit more metallic, so we need now to make new computations at this metallicity. I will finish speaking very rapidly about the polluter IMF and the globular cluster initial mass. It has been discussed several times this morning. Just to remind you the numbers that we have to explain, 15% of third generation normal stars and 85% of second generation anomaly stars. In order to try to estimate the IMF or the initial mass of the cluster, we have imagined two very simple scenarios. In both scenarios, so the first one here on the left and the second one on the right, in both scenarios, the third generation stars are in black and the second generation are in red. So in the first scenario, we say that the globular cluster keeps constant stellar mass. So in that case, we have to change the IMF. And in the second scenario, we allow the massive third generation massive stars to sink at the center of the cluster, where they will produce these second generation stars in red here. And then, due to any possible mechanism, you will use these preferentially these second generation stars, which are here in black. In order to estimate this initial mass function, etc., we have made the assumption that the second generation stars are only low mass stars. There is no production of massive stars, otherwise the problem is even worse than what we find. So for the IMF, for the low mass stars, first generation and second generation, we use the present-day mass function of Faraday and the Marquis. And in the first, for the first scenario, we are looking for this IMF for the most massive stars. And in the second scenario, we assume a sulfur IMF. So here are the results for NGC 6752. So we are using the amount of material which is really ejected by the massive stars that we are computing. And in the case of the scenario one, where the globular cluster stays at constant mass, the required IMF is below 0.55. Now, in the case of scenario two, we find that, so this is a case where you assume a sulfur IMF for the polluters, you need to lose 96% of the first generation long-lived stars, which means that the initial mass of the cluster was 5 times higher than the globular cluster mass today. Of course, these values may change a little bit, so we have to look at the distribution of oxygen and hydrogen in different clusters. And now, I think I'm done, so I'm going to summarize. So again, these anticoalitions require early pollution of the intracluster gas by a first generation of massive and fast-evolving stars. This is an interesting property of globular clusters. This requires potent capture nucleosynthesis at a relatively high temperature, and there are two potential polluters in the literature. There are some difficulties with the AGB scenario. The first one is nucleosynthesis, not the least one for us, of course. So the main difficulty is to avoid this buildup of helium burning products. But if you do that, then you don't have magnesium anymore, magnesium sulfate anymore. You don't have sodium unless you play with nuclear reactions. In the latest model by Ventura and D'Antona, you have a very reduced mass range, which means that in that case, the IMF must be extremely strange, below 0.15. And in the case where you believe that rotation is necessary to explain other chemical features in the galaxy, then you have a very strong increase of the C plus N plus 4 already during the second budget, which is very strong metallicity dependent. And this is not in agreement with the observation in the cluster. Now you have the alternative scenario of gently blowing winds of rapidly rotating massive stars, which eject slow material loaded in hydrogen burning products only, and which may be naturally triggering formation in the vicinity, immediate vicinity of stars. This implies that in globular clusters, we may have some different mode of star formation in circumstellar disk ejected at breakup velocity. And I want to insist on the fact that this fast rotation is not something that you just invent for a globular cluster. It has been needed for other issues, chemical issues in the galaxy. The constraints from the over ENA observations regarding the IMF are given here. And again, you can escape from these constraints by assuming that the cluster has lost a lot of its third generation stars. And just another new graph that I added before my talk is the production of helium is of course natural in massive stars because it's hydrogen burning, so it's, of course you produce a lot of helium. And here I show you the distribution of helium of low mass star of second generation that you may have in all second scenario, and you see that you may have also some stars which reach helium mass fraction as high as 0.7.
We'll start in the front row again.
A lot of the rotational models that don't have magnetic fields in generate a tremendous amount of shear, in which case you get more mixing. So one question for your models is, for example, what do you predict for the white dwarf rotation rates from those super AGB stars? And do you have any magnetic field effects in?
Okay, so for the For the rotation it's, of the white dwarf, there is a difficulty, but I think the difficulty is due to the fact that for the moment we don't include all the transport processes, and in particular we don't include, nobody does, the transport of angular momentum through gravity waves, which may be very important on the HD phase. So a way to relieve this problem of the white dwarf thing, we have to take into account gravity waves. But, I mean, we can discuss that because it's, well, we can discuss that later.
I might guess that each fast rotator would give off a slightly different enhanced helium abundance. But it seemed to be from the observations that the second generation sequence was very well defined and had a low spread in helium abundance. Is there a potential issue there?
Yeah, there is a potential issue. I have no answer.
Observationally, what fraction of stars in the relevant mass range here show BE type outflows? And also, what's understood about how the BE type behavior depends on metallicity?
The BE type, they are, the masses are much lower than the ones that I show now. So for the moment, we have no observational clues. I mean, we would have to go to very young clusters to try to look at that. We don't have such young clusters now to constrain that. But at least in the nature, you find some decreasing disk around fast rotating stars, even if the mass range is not exactly the same, at least that exists somewhere.
Well, my question very much connected to what Fred just asked, but just a bit more going to the field population too. So, like, consider what's the minimum velocity when your effect works, what's the metallicity, and how it will affect like a neutron star production, even in the field, or black holes production. Because if it decreases, it will affect the entire population everywhere, right?
Yeah. The number of neutron stars is in the paper, so I don't have that in the top of my head, but we can look at that. The important point is that there is a minimum initial rotation velocity or ratio between omega over omega precis that you need to have such a scenario. And this is about 70% of the critical rotation velocity that you need to have at the beginning. So you may have not this situation in the field. That may be different in the field and in the clusters if the dense population makes the rotator going faster in the globular cluster, etc. So I'm not sure I answer to your question. Yes. At the beginning, they have to rotate at 70% of their critical velocity, but very rapidly they reach the breaker because you have this transport of angular momentum through the original circulation and turbulence. So they reach the breaker even if you start at 70% of the initial rotation velocity, critical velocity. Right?
So one way of getting...
Yes, again, I have the numbers in the paper. We can look at that.
So one way of getting around the problem of having a non-uniform helium abundance, as was pointed out somewhere over there, from each one of these things, is instead of forming the stars in the decretion disk, to then have this matter that's coming off of these things collect in the center of the cluster, as was suggested for the AGB thing, mix it all up so you have one helium abundance thing, and you produce there. But I'm curious whether this might cause a time scale problem. If it takes too long to move the material to the center of the cluster, cool it down, and form stars there.
Well, there may be a time scale problem, but there is a chemical problem. Because if you mix everything, then you will end up with only one value for oxygen and sodium. And this value is very close from the initial one. So I think the AGB have the same kind of problems, actually. If you mix all this material all together, then at the end, you end up with only one value, which is close from the initial one.
We are running out of time because it's lunch, but Enrico has a question, and
just
then Paul, and then
comment and a quick question. The comment is, every time you choose a flatter IMF to avoid to lose mass, you're making the cluster more unstable because, as, again, Dave Chernoff has showed, if you flatten the IMF, you are increasing the mass you are going to lose by supernova. So the cluster is, you are going to make it really unstable, so even worse than, so you,
I don't want to choose that IMF. I just show you the two extremes.
Yes, yes. No, I was.
And then
I was just saying that you are requiring a flatter IMF to keep the mass low and constant, and it's going. It's just a comment.
I think it's the opposite. That's the cure, for sure.
And the question is, what happens if your rotating massive star is in a binary? So what happens? Can you still use that gas? Or are you losing a fraction of the massive stars if a fraction of those are in binary?
Well, maybe if you give me one more coffee break, I can.
One more question, then we're done.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, if the enrichment comes from BE stars, or, you know, very massive stars, I guess the enrichment has to be very quick, within 10 million years or something. So you wouldn't necessarily expect any secondary population to have several hundred million years age difference with the first one.
Yes, the mass range that I just show you the predictions for the 60 solar masses, but the mass range which is concerned goes is from above 25 solar masses. So,
Okay, let's thank all our speakers again.